From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We've all heard plenty of stories about how the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, has changed the landscape when it comes to individuals and medical insurance. But what has it meant for healthcare providers? Today on the show, we will hear from three hospital administrators who will share firsthand the changes they're seeing since the ACA was implemented, and how those changes might affect you. With me in the studio, Dr. Barbara Crowley. She is the Executive Vice President for Maine General Center in Augusta. Becky Arsenault is President and CEO of Franklin Community Health Network in Farmington. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Michelle Hood, President and CEO of Eastern Maine Healthcare Systems. We invite you to join our conversation. What questions do you have about how the Affordable Care Act is affecting healthcare providers? Have you noticed anything different since your last visit to a hospital or doctor? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling, or you can post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. This is such a big topic, and we're going to get to some specific elements in just a minute. But why don't I start by just asking each of you, how has this affected your hospital so far the most? Barbara.
Well, Jennifer, first, thanks for having us. And I think this is probably the most dynamic time in healthcare in the 30 years I've been in healthcare. Sometimes we like to call it the whitewater time. But it's changing everything from how primary care does its work, how primary care then coordinates with other parts of the system, and how the acute settings, the hospitals, the long-term care settings, nursing settings, have to work to coordinate back. So while we have probably one of the most highly sophisticated and technical healthcare systems, we are not a well-coordinated system. So much of our work is how do we reinvent ourselves in a much more coordinated way.
All right, Becky, would you like to add to that?
Well, I would echo what Barbara has just outlined. It is clearly impacting healthcare providers in a very broad way. Very specifically, however, I think we as healthcare providers, whether it is the acute hospital setting or primary care practices in the community, we are focusing on what I'll call transitions of care. What do I mean by that? We now have to focus on, be concerned about, and manage as patients go from one care setting to another, whether they're in a hospital, going to a nursing home, in a hospital, then going back to their home and being followed up by their primary care provider. In the past, we saw that as a patient obligation and a family obligation. Now, I think in the new world of healthcare reform, it is all of our obligations, and we take it very seriously. So when I talk about care transitions, it's patients getting care in a variety of settings, and how do we as healthcare providers make sure that that patient has a smooth transition, certainly from one care provider to another.
It's interesting you say that because I've long thought what a burden it is for somebody who's going through something major in their lives to try to keep track of everything they need to keep track of. If they've had an illness and then they've been hospitalized and then perhaps they have care when they return home. And for that person to have to keep that all in their mind while they fight that illness is an awful lot.
Most people can't do that. And I think that's where there have been challenges for patients and for families. It is very, very difficult. And one of the changes organizations have been making, again, in response to this radically changing world of healthcare, is how can we put in place support functions? There are actually positions in our respective organizations called nurse navigators, and maybe we can talk about that a little later, for that very reason, Jennifer.
I'm writing that down. Nurse navigators. We'll come back to that. Michelle Hood, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. Eastern Maine Healthcare Systems, one of the largest in the state. How has the ACA affected how you operate so far, and what are you looking at in the future?
Well, thank you for having me, Jennifer. I would also echo what Becky and Barbara have to say about the changes related to the individual patient's experience with healthcare and the provider community. And by providers, I mean hospitals, long-term care facilities, assisted living, home care, physician offices, every aspect of the care continuum are being incentivized to coordinate care in a much more standardized fashion. I would also say that the Affordable Care Act really has accelerated work that was already in process in most of our systems across the country relative to bending the cost curve, if you will, working on what Dr. Don Berwick termed the triple aim, which was, you know, improving the experience of individual patients, changing the cost of care for the country, and the third leg of that triple aim being population health management. So we were focused on that as provider communities previous to the Affordable Care Act, but the Affordable Care Act lent some stimulus to and acceleration to those efforts by requiring and incentivizing providers to standardize around clinical information technology and really work at where the cost is in the system, which is caring for patients and populations of patients with chronic illnesses. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, I know a big part of bending the cost curve, as you say, and doing this, what seems like a really, really tall order, which is reducing patient costs at the same time improving care, a big part of it is moving away from the fee-from-service model that has been, you know, the predominant model so far in healthcare. If you could explain a little bit, Michelle, for people who are not covering this closely, what does it mean to move away from the fee-for-service model? Where are we going, and how does that improve care and cut costs?
So I think that moving away from fee-for-service approaches to delivering care, which basically is they, you know, you go to your physician's office, you have a visit, he or she runs labs or other diagnostic services, you're paying on a per item of consumption basis, the time in the physician's office, any kinds of laboratory or other diagnostic services. Now we're really working towards value-based purchasing, where in fact I think we're moving fairly quickly into something that is I think about it as a case cost on steroids, where we might be, for example, now most of our payers don't pay on an inpatient basis for consumption based upon, you know, the individual utilization. They pay a standardized cost for whatever that patient is in the hospital for.
So if someone has a hip replacement surgery, there's a set cost as opposed to one for the anesthesia, one cost for the actual surgery, one cost for the nursing care afterwards. There's a set cost.
That's right. And we've been under that system in the inpatient world for some years now. But with the Affordable Care Act, we're taking that, I think, to the next generation, which is allowing providers to assume the risk for caring for populations of patient and away from that individual one-by-one kind of approach to payments and delivery, which we could not have done just as recently, probably as 5 or 10 years ago, because we didn't have the clinical information technology to help us make good risk-based decisions on what it is that works well for patients in these various at-risk populations.
Barbara, you wanted to jump in.
So prior to becoming administrator, my career was as a pediatrician, and much of my world was spent in taking care of one child and their family and then the next and the next. And though we occasionally would pull back and take a look at how well we were doing overall in immunizations, that is the whole transition that we need to make now. We need to continue to take care of each individual and their family well, but we also need to spend resources and time looking at the entire population that we're meant to serve, both those that are coming to our doors, into our ORs and our practices, and those who aren't. We need to be able to reach out and help those who maybe aren't getting the care that they need to get come in, because where we're going to go is we're going to move from getting paid every time we have a face-to-face visit or see somebody to being paid a budget to take care of a whole population.
And Becky, you want to
Jennifer?
Go ahead, Michelle.
No, I was just going to go back to a comment you made about the fact that it's very difficult to balance this improved quality effort. And if you look at the data, it's very promising at this point. We're seeing very definitive improvements in the quality of care, reduction of preventable errors, higher immunization rates, as Barbara just mentioned, lower infection rates, and so forth across the country. We're really, and in pockets, just really stupendous quality improvements. But what, one of the things we've learned is that, you know, that doesn't necessarily cost more. And in fact, quality should bring value to the equation, which allows us to spread our dollars further. So, for example, at EMHS, where we've been care coordinating at-risk populations for about 4.5 or 5 years now, we've actually seen a reduction in hospital admissions for at-risk populations and for our own employee population, which we have been managing aggressively for about 6 years. And our admission rates for our own employee populations have gone down almost 30%.
Becky Arsenault, I think of the three of you, your hospital is in the most rural part of Maine. Are the issues the different or the same for Franklin as opposed to hospitals in larger cities?
You know, I think a combination. I think most of the challenges are the same. I think the challenges for our patients and families are somewhat unique. As we look at things like lack of public transportation, to really get to doctor's appointments and so forth. But generally, they're the same. And as I think about the population served by Michelle's organization and Barbara's, it's all pretty rural when you think about it.
Right, compared to New York City or Boston.
True.
Yeah.
True. I think the in some ways, being in a rural area, we have an opportunity to be even more creative. I mentioned earlier that we have really been looking at changing to a culture of continuity. And I referenced the focus on care transitions before. And by virtue of an example, my hospital, Franklin Memorial Hospital, also sponsors the local ambulance service. North Star Ambulance covers 2,800 square miles all the way to the Canadian border. We have 5 ambulance bases that do that. They respond to 911 calls and do patient transports. But something they've been doing now informally for several years is they know where vulnerable people live in the community. They know an individual who lives alone down a long dirt road, and they check on those individuals. We call them checks. And it sounds simple, but as we really look at getting out into the community and identifying individuals who are vulnerable, it is the sort of thing I think in rural areas we can be a little bit more creative about. One of the requirements of the Affordable Care Act is that every hospital do a community needs assessment. And all of our organizations have done those, I think, for a number of years. But in Franklin County, I can tell you, we completed our needs assessment several months ago. And a data-driven approach, really looking at some of the most fundamental needs. For us, it is really looking at the population and the incidence of colorectal cancer. And so that is something we're going to be focusing on. How can we get out there and really work with people in the community on screening to do that early prevention work? Now, for the most part, we don't have extensive resources to dedicate to that important community endeavor. And in the long term, we hope that will actually cause people to use fewer acute care services if we can prevent or screen up front.
And does the ACA provide incentive for you all for Franklin to do this?
Not specifically. But certainly as we look at health insurance providers, there is a new focus on wellness visits. But does that cover the cost of the person power to be out there in the community, really, in some cases, going door to door to work with people? No, it doesn't. That leaves us in a situation where we are moving from your reference to fee for service. The more we do, the more we get paid, to an environment where we have to figure out how to get those resources reallocated, focus on the population health and wellness, in an era where there aren't really designated funds to help us make this incredible transition that is important for the health of our nation, actually.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Health, working with member organizations like CenterNet to help make our communities the healthiest in America. MaineHealth.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how antibiotics, cesarean sections, and sanitizers are destroying the balance of the human microbiome, the massive collection of microorganisms that live in and on our bodies. We talk with Dr. Martin Blaser, who speculates that changes in the microbiome may be contributing to obesity, asthma, and allergies. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock here on MPBN. The Maine Capitol Connection Channel provides daily coverage of the Maine State Legislature in Augusta, offering House and Senate sessions, select committee hearings, and also occasional interviews and press conferences. It starts at 10 each morning and usually rebroadcasts the day's coverage at 7 each evening. The Maine Capitol Connection Channel is available over the air and on the digital tier of many of Maine's cable companies. For information about the channel, including how to find it, what channel it might be on, and the current schedule, visit mpbn.net or call MPBN Audience Services. We're at 1-800-884-1717.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the ACA and hospitals. With me in the studio, Dr. Barbara Crowley. She is Executive Vice President for Maine General Medical Center in Augusta. Rebecca Arsenault is President and CEO of the Franklin Community Health Network in Farmington. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Michelle Hood, President and CEO of the Eastern Maine Healthcare Systems. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to get to David in Bangor in just a minute. But first, I wanted to talk about one topic that I know is very important to this whole formula, and that's reducing hospital readmissions. It seems to me, Barbara, that this is almost a 180 from where we were 10, 15 years ago when hospitals were, you know, in the era when I was having babies, hospitals were keeping people in for as short a period of time as possible and kicking them out the door. Now it seems as though people are maybe even staying in a little bit longer to make sure that they will not be coming back. Is that too superficial a read of what's going on?
Well, I would reframe it a bit differently than that. And as you already heard from Becky, this work around how do we help with care transitions. Some of us are trying to take the word hospital discharge out of our vocabulary because we don't really want to be discharging you off of a cliff onto whatever is your next site of care. So I would say we want to have you in the hospital as long as necessary to make sure that you and your family know how to transition you to the next point of care. Now, often that is sometimes even a shorter period of time if we can move you to home care or get your primary care physician and practice involved ahead of time. So the less time you can spend in the hospital, the less opportunity for complications or infections, but the better you're prepared for the next transition is our goal.
Go ahead, Becky.
Well, you know, at Franklin Memorial Hospital, we have focused on this particular issue now in a significant way over the past 2 years, as have other hospitals in the state and across the country. Very specifically, we have managed to reduce our readmission, our 30-day readmission rate, from 16% to 8% in that window of time. How have we done that? First of all, we have asked patients when they have come back into the hospital, let's say within a 2 or 3 week window of being discharged, what happened that caused you to come back, and get as detailed about that as possible. And what we have discovered has been a number of things. Patients did not understand the medication they were going home on, or they understood the medications and went home and took not only their new medications, but some old medications they had lying around, to be honest, We had not done a good job in the hospital making absolutely certain that patient understood which medications, how much, and which medications to stop taking. So we discovered that. Instructions, other instructions for patients going home, their activity level. What should they be doing and not doing during the first 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks? It's pretty difficult in rural areas. A patient going home alone, we tell them they really need to take it easy, but we forget to ask them, what is their fuel source? And we discovered the patient went home, went out and chopped wood because they needed wood for the fire, and got sick again and came back into the hospital. We also work very, very closely with the family in looking at what other psychosocial issues might impact that patient upon discharge. So we are down to that level of detail. If a patient goes home, we make absolutely certain that he or she has a follow-up appointment with their primary care physician within just a few days of discharge. That is very new and different for us over the last year or so. It used to be the patient had a follow-up appointment in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and we discovered that was much too long. They need to see their primary care provider who knows them well in the community, and they need to see that provider within just a few days.
Okay, going to calls now. This is David in Bangor. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Thanks for taking the call. It's very informative. I'm a private physician in the area, and I was just interested. I know there's been a lot of research, both from the academic setting and from governmental committees that recently have found that the consolidation of care appears to be actually driving up healthcare costs and decreasing the patient's choice. I know that the private physicians in the state of Maine are have dropped in the last 10 years by about 2.5 times the national rate, which is now, I guess, gone from 85% down to 30% in the state of Maine. And I think a large part of why the hospitals are able to sort of try to automate the care there, and physicians are able to run shifts and sort of be more of that 24/7 physician that I know that they would like to see.
David, are you talking about the shift toward accountable care organizations?
Well, I'm actually, that's certainly part of it. I think that is just going to be the next tier of consolidation of care. But I think that over the last 10 years, the number of physicians that actually are employed by the hospitals has increased, you know, quite dramatically, which is, I think, you know, part of the problem, I think, is that some patients feel that their private physicians that they've been with for quite some time are now sort of forcing their care to be taking place in the hospital setting, which oftentimes is accompanied by facility fees that, say, a private physician's office visit would not, you know, would not be accompanied by. I work in a building where there are hospital employed physicians also in the building, and they have been able for years to charge facility fees on top of their consultations.
Right. I think you're making a very good point in this conversation. I'm going to have Michelle Hood respond to you, but I want to make it clear that I know there are organizations such as Martin's Point in Maine that are non-hospital affiliated physician practices that we do not have on the program today. But Michelle Hood, would you like to respond to David's thoughts about what consolidation means for physicians and for the patient experience?
Certainly. You know, the economics of consolidation continue to evolve, and I think the more recent studies have actually indicated that the consolidation, especially in rural areas, has contributed to a decrease in the overall cost of healthcare delivery. That's not to say that in some markets where there's tremendous competition between large networks of sometimes academic-based but other times just community-based hospital networks with physician employment, that the competition is not driving some expenses up. So it's an area where health economics experts continue to study the impact of consolidation. I think from a patient satisfaction perspective, particularly I'll speak about the market in Maine. I think we still have enough variability and variance with the presence of large independent and some small independent physician practices. We still have a very strong representation of federally qualified health centers in the state. Those provide patients with choice while still allowing for an organizational model, sometimes driven through contractual arrangements between, for example, FQHCs and health systems that allow the patient to have the advantage of a coordinated care without a business model consolidation on top of it.
David, you wanted to jump in there?
Well, I guess I'm not sure the difference between a rural setting and a busier setting, but I do think that the most recent evidence shows that when there is a lack of competition between hospital systems or between physicians, then that natural tendency to provide the best of care at the lowest price disappears, and that the actual cost of care goes up, not so much because of increase in utilization, but actually an increase in the price placed by the institution with the greatest market control. So I guess I would beg it to differ a little bit with that, and maybe that's more recent. I just know there's been a lot in the New York Times recently, and there's been some research in England where they've taken some systems and they have added competition into the system and watched what happened over the course of 6 to 10 years. And they found that the quality increased, that the readmissions decreased, and the cost decreased. So that's actually from the England healthcare system. But anyway, I can take your response off the air. Thank
okay,
you so
thank
much.
You, David. I appreciate your call. I'm going to go to another call. Jane in Orono. Hi, Jane. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Good morning. Well, good afternoon now. I have some real questions about the whole jargon surrounding the healthcare system. I'd like us to all step back and realize that the Affordable Care Act, as it was originally planned, was not designed to have the insurance companies basically setting the tone and the implementation along with the IRS of this system. Now, hospitals have investors, and some hospitals, like two or three years ago, I think AMM, cleared about $3.5 billion with 17 holdings or 18 holdings of you know, healthcare facilities. I just feel like the team approach and the possibility of using alternative medicine and modes and cleaning up the environment within these hospital systems and opening up to breaking apart the culture and the mindset of marching along under this commodification would help the health of our country so much more.
Okay, thank you. Becky Arsenault, would you like to respond?
Well, you know, I think Jane raises several important questions. The Affordable Care Act has so many parts and pieces. Here we are 4 years later, and we're still trying to figure out all of those parts and pieces. There is a lot in the Affordable Care Act that has structured, restructured, placed restrictions upon health insurance companies, has made clear what their profit margins can be and cannot exceed. And so I think that is still in the process of unfolding. Remember, the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010. And many of the regulations associated with that, very comprehensive and wide-sweeping federal legislation, are still in the process of being written, quite frankly. But embedded in the Affordable Care Act, I think, is an important point that the caller made, and that is, how can we move our healthcare system in this country really to one where we are focusing not on just medicine, but the overall health and wellness of our population. And that includes such factors as environmental factors. What's out there in our community causing people to not follow healthy behavior, lifestyles, actual environmental factors that negatively impact people's medical condition. And so I think it is embedded in the Affordable Care Act, as I mentioned earlier, that the fact that we are looking at community health needs assessments, that's not just about hospital services and physician services. That is looking at broad health issues in our service areas. And what are we going to do as healthcare providers to impact those important considerations for people's overall health and wellness?
So we're really just at the beginning of all of this.
We are at such the beginning, and I think it is frustrating, certainly for those of us who are in healthcare. It's almost as if we would all like to leap forward a number of years and be able to look back and say, there, we actually have moved our country, our state, our citizens to a place of focusing more on health and wellness, and that each of us as individuals take that personal accountability for our health and our family's health. But that's not the way this is working, nor will it work. It's incremental, and it's every day we're really looking at the next step.
All right. And Barbara, that's a point you wanted to make, talking about each of us taking control of our own health and thinking about things differently.
That's right. And, you know, I think we all need to understand that clinical medicine can affect about 20% of our overall health. 30% are affected by our behaviors. And frankly, we in healthcare need to be better at using these opportunities when patients come to see us in our various settings to how can we best understand what the priorities and values are of the individual and how to set goals with them so that when they spend very little time in our presence, when most of their time at home or in their communities, how can they be participating and changing to healthier behaviors?
Well, Jane, thank you so much for the call that started all that. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We're going to take another quick break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston, committed to 100% wind-powered beer production. BaxterBrewing.com.
Intelligence Squared U.S., where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues.
Everything has changed around us, but the university education system hasn't.
Online education will not replace the great colleges and universities in the United States.
The motion up for debate, will online education make the lecture hall obsolete?
That's coming up later today on Intelligence Squared at 1 o'clock here on MPBN. Join MPBN on Facebook and over 12,000 friends of MPBN for notes about special programming and events, questions for you and from you about our television, radio, and online programming and services, conversations with other listeners who may not always have the same opinion as you, also schedule updates, information, and news about MPBN. We invite you to become an MPBN Facebook friend and connect with other listeners and viewers. If you like MPBN On Air, like us on Facebook, too.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how has and will the Affordable Care Act affected healthcare providers? With me in the studio, Rebecca Arsenault, president and CEO of Franklin Community Health Network in Farmington. Dr. Barbara Crowley, the Executive Vice President for Maine General Medical Center in Augusta. And joining us from our Bangor studio is Michelle Hood, President and CEO of the Eastern Maine Healthcare Systems. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Ted. Could your panel reflect on the ability or inability of the legislature and governor failure to expand Maine care coverage? The reason I ask this is their ERs are going to take up the slack of the uncovered and uninsured. Michelle Hood.
Well, we certainly continue to work with legislators and with the executive branch of the state government looking for the solution around Maine care expansion. The hospitals through the Maine Hospital Association, which represents all of the hospitals in the state of Maine, certainly supported Maine care expansion. And it's a complicated topic. Certainly understand that we need to be concerned about the sustainability of a program and the size of that program going forward, and that we aren't guaranteed federal assistance at the high level that they have obligated themselves to at this point in time forever. But at the same time, the hospital community and physician offices and practices across the state are seeing decreases in Medicare reimbursement, which were intended to help pay for the expansion of Medicaid and then the new insurance products that were offered on the state exchanges. So it is a complicated issue, short-term issues counterbalanced by long-term ability to afford the program. We're in good conversations with the executive branch and the legislative branch of the state government around the fact that the solution may be a hybrid of some sort that allows us to apply population health management to the highest risk patient populations within Medicaid or Maine Care, as we call it here. Apply that principle that it doesn't necessarily cost more to provide, really highly intensive care coordination. And in fact, we can get some long-term economic benefit from that.
Okay, thank you. Going to Steve in Orono. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Yeah, I mean, there's so many roads and doors into this whole issue, but I remember reading in USA Today where MedPAC, which is funded by Congress, said that as early as 2011, they said that hospitals buying physician practices was the reason that we all ended up paying about $1.5 billion more in higher Medicare program costs, because hospitals were billing, for example, 80% more for office visits than they were when they were in the doc's office, or 70% more for echocardiograms, that kind of thing. So is Maine bucking the trend? I guess my point is, you know, are the hospitals buying the doc practices for, I think MedPAC called it a windfall for the hospitals, but yet I'm not hearing that from your guests. They're getting paid less for Medicaid, not Medicare.
Okay, thank you, Steve. You know, Michelle Hood fielded the last question about consolidation, so I'll have one of you. When the smaller hospitals, are your hospitals also buying physician practices? Is this something that you've been doing, and has there been a change in the patient cost? Go ahead. Barbara Crowley.
So it's true, and at Maine General, actually 70% of our physician staff is employed not all by us. Some are employed by the FQHCs or by the residents.
What does that mean, the FQHC,
the
Michelle?
Federally Qualified Health Centers.
Okay.
And as the earlier caller said, it is true that in the public payers, both Maine Care and Medicare, there is an additional fee that can be applied to being a facility. When you're owned by a medical center, there is an additional fee. And I would acknowledge that. But having said that, let's also acknowledge that Maine overall is in the lower third of costs for Medicare individuals. So we usually talk about this in a per member per month way, but across this country, Maine is in the lower third for the overall cost. So even though it is true there is some additional fees being paid to primary care and to physician practices for being owned by the hospitals, the overall cost in Maine is lower than most of the country.
And Becky, go ahead.
Well, I think, again, it is different in different geographic areas, and that certainly applies to across the country. In Franklin County, I can tell you the hospital has never bought a physician's practice. Physicians have asked to be employed because they could not keep their doors open in private practice. And that trend started approximately 15 years ago in Franklin County. Today, either the hospital or federally qualified health clinic employs about 80% of physician providers throughout the county. It has been an economic challenge for private physicians throughout our communities, primarily because there are so many patients who are covered by Medicare and Medicaid, Maine Care. We don't have a lot of businesses in Franklin County, so we don't have a lot of individuals with commercial health insurance. So it has been a long-standing pattern and trend, certainly for this rural county, where the only way there could be physician services for all in Franklin County is if the hospital stepped up to the plate and employed them. And it wasn't about going out and buying the practice so that we could bring on all these doctors, so that we could bill Medicare and Medicaid more, and life would be good.
And it sounds as though this is not because of the ACA, because the ACA is 2 years old, and this has been going on for 15 years. So we're going to go to Nemo and Steuben. Go ahead. What's your question?
It's not a question. It's a statement, first of all. I just finished a treatment at Eastern Maine in Bangor, and the treatment I got was fabulous. I don't think Conrad Hilton in any of his hotels could have provided better treatment and care. Second, regarding Obamacare, we're in a country that's used to problems in setting up. General Motors is calling back zillions of cars, Toyota, et cetera, et cetera. Then on the other hand, we've got a governor who says we're a family, but at the same time says we can't be fiscally irresponsible by insuring people. If this is a family, wouldn't the governor go into debt if his family was in need?
Michelle Hood, I'm going to let you respond because it started with a compliment for your for EMC.
Well, thank you, Nemo, for sharing that, and I'm glad you had a great experience at Eastern Maine Medical Center. You know, the issue of what to spend now in anticipation of what the cost might be in the future is really a difficult one. And I certainly would not be critical of anybody's interpretation of the downstream impact of the decisions of today. These are, as one of my fellow panelists here said earlier, you know, these are very complicating times. There are so much uncertainty left as to how this Affordable Care Act will be implemented. I don't know what the impact of Secretary Sebelius's resignation might be. We'll have a different set of eyes at the highest administrative level of the Department of Health and Human Services in D.C., and that Secretary of Health and Human Services has a tremendous amount of discretionary power as it relates to the administration of the Affordable Care Act. You couple that with the impending midterm elections and the political influence of those races and the outcome of those races and the what that will mean. I think that we're in for just at least another 18 to 24 months, probably more like 36 months of huge uncertainty as this all shakes out. I think of that as I'm optimistic about that because I think we still have a lot of opportunity to influence the product that comes out the other end, the health plan, both the reimbursement portion of it and the delivery portion of it that we will come out with at the end of this process. It's an unprecedented time of change for us, but there's still a lot of opportunity to make this a very positive impact for everyone. Right now, it's just tremendously chaotic.
Well, let me run with that thread because Becky mentioned this earlier, that so much of the law is still being written. Now that you all have stuck your toe in or maybe your whole foot into this ACA experience, as the law is continuing to be written and worked on, what would you like to see that you're not getting now as hospital administrators? What would make this a better system for your hospitals in your parts of Maine? Barbara?
Well, one thing we haven't talked about, but at the foundation of all this is the coordination of care that often is a primary care task. So we have seen additional dollars and learning collaboratives come into Maine for more than 150 primary care practices that Quality Counts has helped to oversee. But data has continued to be a major barrier. You can't change what you can't measure. So I need both from the federal government with Medicare, from our own state with MaineCare, and from the commercial health plans to have better data coming to us so that we can begin to look at what is the utilization of the individuals we're taking care of, and so that we might reach out to those that have very high utilizations and see if we can't, in a voluntary way, engage with them providing greater care management. But data is a key function that we need more of.
And I'm guessing, Becky, that part of what you would like is funding for things like you were talking about earlier, screening for colorectal problems. What would you like to see coming forward from this new system?
Well, I echo what Barbara just said. That was actually the first words on my tongue was the data. But I would also add to that, I believe that there is a lot that the federal government and our state government could do to begin to engage individuals in a very significant way in all of us understanding our own responsibility and accountability to be part of this. I don't know how to do that exactly, but I think if I identified along with data, one other thing it would be, there needs to be, I think, national momentum, a national campaign, if you will, to really talk about how each one of us as individuals has to be involved in this reform. And it is a reform. And it's not about what hospitals are doing or what doctors are doing. It's what do we want as a society for a new healthcare world. And that has to involve individuals and all of us changing our mindset from one of being consumers of services to being accountable for our own health and overall wellness.
Michelle Hood.
Well, believe it or not, both Barbara and Becky had the first two things that I wrote on my list as soon as you asked the question. I put personal responsibility incentives because I think there is a tremendous amount that we can do to help individuals be better consumers of health care. And a lot of times our hands are tied because of very strict rules around incentives. And one thing certainly at the state level with the MaineCare program is the use of co-pays and other kinds of opportunities to have the enrollee make good decisions about his or her health care certainly could be very helpful. We are and have been working on common data sets across the country. We've got a lot more work to do in that regard. I'm optimistic because we are largely digitized at this point, so we're getting just scads of information out of the electronic medical records, and we're getting better about predictive analytics and all of the kinds of high-powered big data kinds of applications that manufacturing and other industries have been using for years in order to predict consumer behavior. So I think, and in our case, certainly evidence-based clinical outcomes are part of that analytic capability. The last one that I would mention that, you know, we all need to work on is administrative simplification. And I don't think the Affordable Care Act did anything at all. It is a huge law, so it's probably unrealistic that it would be able to address everything. But we waste a lot of dollars and manpower and effort across our industry of healthcare around the administrative functions. And by that, I mean the processing of claims, the coding, and all the things that go along with that. With the use of information technology, we should be able to simplify the administrative aspects and save our healthcare system a whole lot of money.
Well, thank you. That's going to be the last word. Michelle, Becky, Dr. Crowley, thank you all for joining us today. Dr. Barbara Crowley, the Executive Vice President for Maine General Medical Center in Augusta. Rebecca Arsenault is President and CEO of the Franklin Community Health Network in Farmington. Michelle Hood, President and CEO of Eastern Maine Healthcare Systems. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Jonathan Woodward ran the board. We had additional help from the Rich Tozier in our Bangor studio and the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. We are also on iTunes. Tomorrow on the program, what does it mean to be mindful? Join me for a conversation about practicing mindfulness, what science is learning about the benefits of meditation, and to learn whether it's right for you. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on MPBN.